Yeah, welcome, welcome very much to Conversations. We're a pleasure to welcome to the program Kai Hayner. He's an old friend of mine. He's PhD, and he's one of the world's leading advocates for and expert on the thinking of the great economist Henry George. And he's with the College of the New York Institute of Technology's instructor, and we've done programs in the past. And Kai, so welcome so much.
Thank you so much.
Conversation here, kicking off 2013 season. I mentioned this giant of a man who I think it might be worthwhile if we could, because I know you're grounded on that, and you've written a paper. You can see on the podium here we have Progress in Poverty. A major work that was developed by him, a major work he's noted, that is Henry George is noted for, and also another one. Let me hold it up there quick, Kai, if you don't
Please,
mind.
Sure.
This is another one, Anatomy of Economic
is Financial it? Destructiveness.
Financial Destructiveness. And we're also going to show a clip of Kai talking to a group presaging the disaster of 2008, which is still relevant and so forth. But a lot of this is all based upon thinking and understanding this giant of a economist, Henry George. And so let's put that over there. Then. And so, Kai, I wonder if maybe you could fill us in a primer kind of way, this fellow, Henry George, and what a huge influence he had on the world intellectual community back in the 19th and early 20th century and so forth, and that his legacy continues, in your view, in a very responsible way for us to understand the economic and human condition.
Oh, absolutely. Henry George is unique in a sense that he foresaw the resources scarcity we're undergoing now. He foresaw the resources problem and the land problem 100 years before anybody else
yeah,
really did.
Yeah.
In the 1870s, in 1879, he wrote this book, Progress in Poverty. He was an investigative journalist. He came from a middle-class background, left home early, home at 40, went around the world twice.
He did some adventuring,
oh,
didn't he?
Oh, he was like Jack London.
Yeah, I mean, like London, yeah.
He had like he went to Klondike, he saw, looked for gold.
Yeah.
He had more adventures under his belt by the time he was 20 than most of us have in all of a lifetime,
right, several lifetimes.
And he also, in his adventures, he experienced dire poverty.
Yeah.
And so he's not just writing. When he writes a book, Progress in Poverty, it's not like he's sitting in front of food and abundance. He himself experienced poverty.
Yeah.
So when he talks about abolishing poverty, he's talking about something that he's experienced and it's under his own skin.
Right.
And there's a very moving part of his biography. He was unemployed. His wife was coming down with a second child. He has no money. He has nothing.
Yeah.
He can't feed his own. So he's going out into the street and he's hitting up the first man for, I think it was $50.
Yeah.
And now if
that was in San Francisco.
That was in San Francisco.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
Exactly.
He was out in Frisco. Yeah.
So imagine nowadays. If somebody hits you up in the subway for a dollar or two or $5, maybe you give it or maybe you don't give it. You don't give somebody $50. Now, back in these days, $50 was real money.
Yeah.
So he looked at the man and the man looked at him and said, what do you need it for? And he said, my wife is coming down with a second child. I'm unemployed. I'm starving.
Uh-huh.
And so the man gave him the money.
Uh-huh.
And he said afterwards, if he hadn't given me the money, I may have just knocked him over the head and taken his wallet.
Wow, that's
how desperate he was.
Yeah, right, right.
But that means he's invested, he has skin in the game, he's invested in abolishing poverty.
Uh-huh.
And then through his investigative journalism, he was a very gifted writer, one of the great economic writers of all times.
Right.
He was through his journalism, and he was an editor of a newspaper, San Francisco Post, for 5 years, so he saw the social issues, the social problems of his time. And on the side he practiced, he read all the classical economists that were available. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, the great economists that were available at his time, he studied them all, and he synthesized them, and he came up with a solution that's unique in economics. He says, We have a slanted economy. We have a monopolization of capital and resources, and that creates an artificial impoverization of the population.
Uh-huh.
And he says, if you can shift through a simple gimmick, you don't have to hang the capitalists, you don't have to do any drastic measures, you shift the taxes from production and from capital and from labor to resources. And once you do that, if you're an industrialist and I'm the government and I tax your revenue, your profits, say 30%. Uh-huh. That means you have 30% less to invest.
Yeah.
Now, if I don't tax you at all, I obviously liberate a lot of money that can be reinvested. I liberate a lot of capital that can go back into reinvestment. Mm. And I take the shift, I shift all the taxes and put it on resources and land. Your production will shrink by 30% if I tax you 30%. Mm. But land and resources are not going to shrink because I tax it. Land and resources, like the air we breathe, the air we breathe is a resource that's a life necessity. Mm-hmm. The water we drink is a life necessity, and so on. So, in a sense, that is something, as life necessities, that has to be made available to everybody. And that's also, all production is based on resources and raw materials. If we don't have raw materials, we can't produce.
That's right. So that's true, yeah.
So basically, he has a very simple gimmick, you can say, a very simple way, shift the taxes, untax capital and labor, and just tax resources.
Mm-hmm. And this was all happening. What year was it published again, the book?
In 1879.
1879. So he was in competition with a lot of what was coming out of those adherents to Mr. Karl Marx and Engels.
It was four years before Marx. 1883, yeah. Marx published his Kapital. So he was ahead of Karl Marx.
Did he have the support of John Stuart Mill?
He had the support of John Stuart Mill.
Or Auguste Comte?
Yes.
That was a very heady time in terms of English intellectual history and so forth.
Yes.
And then he also got the support of Sun Yat-sen.
Absolutely.
Leo Tolstoy, Mark
awesome.
Twain.
Oh, you're very, and the well, intellectual read. You're very well read.
I think, the intellectual giants of the time were, progressively minded people of the time, were very much signed on to him, and he had a heavy influence in terms of the world intellectual community on matters of great import.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
John Dewey, Winston Churchill. I mean, the great progressive minds there were all on the bandwagon. They were all on the bandwagon. I mean, Tolstoy says you can't, Henry George's teachings cannot be refuted, it can only be ignored.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Tulsa was very big on
so that. What was the, if we come into the 20th century and so forth, we had a Great Depression looming in the 20s and
up
and down. We'd had those kind of things. What was to be the result? Because he came across both sides of the 20th century, divide, 19th, 20th century. What was the legacy of him that was able to carry on in terms of, and maybe then being inclusive or subsumed or something by the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, mm-hmm. that sent the modern context to bring it up more to date in terms of his contributions? How effective have they been? What legislation or aspects of the overall world economy seen now live that were results of his input? Or what should be resurrected of his thinking relevant to the future that we would pay attention to the benefit of human progress?
I'm glad you're bringing up the Great Depression, Harold, because when I teach economics and when I used to run the Henry George School and I taught economics there, the Great Depression was always used as the prime example. This was a complete breakdown of civilization, in a sense. It was a complete breakdown of the economics and finances
traumatic.
Of the time. It was traumatic.
It was very traumatic.
But now we're having this book out here because now the great example is not the Great Depression anymore. The great example is the Great Recession of 2008.
You're really seeing it in those terms.
If you ask Krugman or Stiglitz or some of the greatest economists, Bernanke.
Yeah. Yeah.
They all say if there hadn't been this extreme interventionism, if there hadn't been this extreme, what's called euphemistically quantitative easing, meaning the huge infusion of capital into the system, we would have had a much worse disaster than the Great Depression.
Okay.
It would have been just calamitous. Now, go back to Franklin Roosevelt, or go back even a little further back. The early presidents of the 20th century were all heavily influenced by Henry George. Teddy Roosevelt, Taft, Woodrow Wilson, they all had people in government who were trying to implement George's policies.
Really?
Because that was the so-called progressive era, and the term progressive is really coined, I mean, it's associated with Woodrow Wilson and with Teddy Roosevelt, but the man who gave a face to the progressive era was Henry George.
Who was the
mastermind behind the progressive era, that was Henry George.
Oh, that's good. And Teddy and T.R. was very influenced by him.
Oh, absolutely. Right? And the
trust busting.
Yes, and the trust busting, that's very much Henry George.
Yeah.
And the national parks, that's resources oriented.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, as a young man, Theodore Roosevelt, before he became governor of New York State and then before he became president, he ran for mayor of New York City and he ran against Henry George. And they had debates. At the time already, they had these debates. So he was doing a three-way debate. There was a Democratic candidate, Abraham Hewitt, Tammany Hall.
Yeah.
There was the Republican candidate, young Theodore Roosevelt, lean and mean. And there was Henry George.
I'll be damned.
And Teddy Roosevelt was so impressed by George's mind that he took on his economic system and his ideas of social justice and his ideas of resources conservation and implemented them later in his presidency.
Uh-huh.
So that's all basically George's doing in getting. When we think of Theodore Roosevelt, he's a very colorful figure. Internationally, he's in a sense a disaster. It's the speak softly, carry the big stick. He's very imperialist, but his domestic policy is very socially just and is very trust busting. Break up the big cartels, break up the big monopolies. That's all Henry George.
Mm-hmm.
So the mastermind behind Teddy Roosevelt in the domestic arena is Henry George.
Did T.R. Say that?
Yes.
He gave credit to him as he did these things that were sort of innovative in terms of social justice.
John Muir, the Sierra Club, Henry David
Thoreau.
Yeah,
he was a great conservationist. Yeah.
Yes, and Henry George. Teddy Roosevelt gave credit, definitely, to that great teaching.
So we talked about the Great Depression. Invoke a name, Lord John Maynard Keynes, came in the Depression and post-Second World War. And it seems to me Keynesian. I remember Mr. Nixon said we're all Keynesians.
I think he was
quoting somebody else, Hayek or something. But he was the one who set up the system, Bretton Woods, all of the major institutions. They probably more than anybody else is associated with the modern economic structure in place, structure in place. And so how does Henry George
figure with Keynes?
Play, as it were, in terms of the politics that emerged out of the Depression and through the 50-year period, you could say, of a Keynesian reigning, which gave such a growth to the middle class and a golden era here in the United States? And how does George play out through those decades-long period?
Well,
that would be called the Age of Keynes, one would say,
if
you think that's about correct.
Yes, I do agree. Keynes, there are things that Keynes and George have in common, and there are things that Keynes and George are greatly divided on. And one of the things that Keynes and George have in common is that they want social justice. They want economic justice. So they have a common goal, if you want.
Yeah.
But the way to get there is different. And Keynes, for all his brilliance, I mean, Bertrand Russell said Keynes is the most the most gifted students I ever had. And Russell himself was no mean. He was no dummy. He was
Bertrand Russell.
He was like
fantastic.
Einstein.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
IQ of 200 something.
And Whitehead.
He was
principal mathematics.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He was one of the great. Russell was not only one of the great philosophers, one of the great socially conscious people of his time.
Yeah.
He was also one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century.
Well, Whitehead particularly.
Whitehead and Russell and Einstein, they are like in the same league. And so if Russell says Keynes is my most gifted students, and Keynes was a great mathematician.
He
had a mathematical analysis of his economic system. The problem with Keynes is Keynes came from a like FDR. He came from a very well off background. He thought like a lord, and he thought like a lord with a social conscience, and he thought like a banker. And
noblesse oblige.
Exactly, noblesse oblige. Exactly. That's it. You have to your status in life. If you're in the privileged class, you're obliged to help others.
Right.
That's a consciousness which is.
I wish we had a little bit more of those quarters now.
Thank you. That's completely lost. That's completely
freebooting. Yeah.
That's completely lost. And now Keynes basically thinks like a banker.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, deficit spending, that's Keynes' big thing. The more debts we have, the better it is. If you're a banker, if everybody has debts with you, that's good for you because you're making money.
Yeah,
and Keynes Keynes was a bursar of was it Oxford or Cambridge, and he did well in doing good.
Right? He's associated with Brenton Woods. Yes, he set everything up, didn't it? More or less in terms of the international order.
What Keynes? It's you can compare him to an Alexander Hamilton to that degree.
Yeah.
Of course, at the end of the imperialist age, with the Second World War ending, the imperialist powers in Europe, France, England, Germany, Italy, they were cutting each other's throat and they were killing each other off. Mm. Basically, they were trying to the globe had been carved off in the colonial age, and now all this had broken down, and you needed a new international system.
Mm-hmm.
And Keynes was one of the first, like Alexander Hamilton was one of the first when the 13 first states came together in the American Revolution. Hamilton had the foresight to see, okay, we have to assume the responsibility of the debts. We want to become a sovereign state.
Yeah.
So he had the foresight to see beyond the horizon and see the larger picture.
Uh-huh.
And so Keynes saw we need a new world order. Mm-hmm. And the new world order obviously needs an orderly financial and economic system.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually worked on the transition from the imperialist age or from the colonialist age into a new financial world order, and some say a neo-colonialist financial order,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
without Keynes, I don't know where we would be, because it would be too parochial.
Yeah, yeah.
World Bank, International Monetary Fund,
right.
All these are...
Well, he had all kinds of Marshall Plan and rebuilding Europe and Japan and all that and everything.
Well, Marshall Plan is very Keynesian. I mean, you had in the First World War, you had this disaster that you had the revanchism. You had the revanchism between France and Germany.
Yeah.
They were engaged in fratricidal wars, horrible wars. Mm. My ancestors come from... They were literally born on the border between France and Germany.
Uh-huh.
Literally, my father and my grandfather, a little bit north in the Rhineland, Aachen, Aix-la-Chapelle.
Mm.
And so, it could have fallen either way. We ended up being German, but there's nobody in my family on all sides, going back generations, who is not Francophile, who has not an extreme appreciation for the French culture.
Yeah.
And every generation, jingoist leaders were sending these whole generations of the best and the brightest against each other, killing millions of people
off.
And there was nobody. There's nobody in my family who has one bad word to say about a Frenchman.
Isn't it silly?
It's like an artificial. It's like the two nations are artificial.
Is it a holdover from the dynastic states? Do you think?
We had under Charlemagne, under Charles the Great, and 800, we had Germany and France was one nation, and now thank God with the European Union. As long as France and Germany, through changing leaders, holds together, we're going to have one Europe.
Yeah,
that's the heart of Europe.
It took James Joyce to have Daedalus say, history is a nightmare of, one could say, stupidity, injustice, from which we're trying to awaken. And maybe that's what we're trying to get at, and Mr. Henry George is trying to get
that's
at.
That's wonderful. But let's get back to Keynes,
okay.
and then come to what's the relevance of Henry George today.
Mm.
So we needed an international financial system. But it was a paternalistic system, and it was the banker would win, and we've made that one of our great leading Georgists. You've had him on your program, Clifford Cobb. He made that film, The End of Poverty.
Yeah.
How can we end poverty? And if you look at the debt service that the so-called third world nations have to pay to the World Bank and the International Monetary Funds, the interest alone is obscene.
Yeah, yeah.
What
structural adjustments all over the place. Yeah.
And if you could use that financial interest payments for building hospitals and schools and infrastructure, you would do a large. You would get rid of a large chunk of poverty.
And a lot of the problems we're confronted with in debt crisis and all that kind of stuff is a result of the inappropriate pattern in place.
No. Ironically enough, we had after in the 70s, Keynes reigned, and we got Milton Friedman, and we got monetarism, and we got the neoclassical economics and non-interventionism, and our last unsuccessful presidential candidate when we had the Sandy Hurricane Sandy disaster, and now the Republicans have blocked the funds to for disaster relief.
Oh, it's coming through. It's coming through.
Yeah. Thank God. I mean, it's like the idea to say, okay, we have a hurricane. 50 million people are impacted. The people are dying. The damages in the billions. And the presidential candidates of the Republicans says it's everybody got his own dinghy, everybody got his own rubber boat. I mean, that's absurd. Mm. So with the crisis of 2008, we're coming back to Keynesianism because a very conservative government, the Bush government, was faced with the choice of either letting the whole world financial system, the whole world economic system sink and collapse and create a horrible disaster, horrible poverty, horrible calamities, or bail everybody out on an unprecedented scale in the trillions of dollars. And that was the Bush government who had started out saying, we are a small government, we are non-interventionist.
I heard you say that you thought that the debacle of 2008 was as bad as or worse than the Great Depression of 1929?
Oh, absolutely.
That's a staggering thing, because the effect of it on the 30s, Tom Joad and Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, oh my God.
Massive
Heartrending film. And heartrending
era,
situation. The Dust Bowl.
Dust Bowl. Yeah, that was a horrible thing, and it certainly seared the soul of America.
Oh my God.
In 2008 would have been that, but it was it not
absolutely
avoided by what was done?
Absolutely.
And so that's a point that ought to be made, even as we tiptoe up to that event that was looming in 2008. Were you and your colleagues were able to see that emerging from before it actually happened, the events of 2008 when they bailed out AIG and they bailed out all the big banks and that sort of thing?
Or
it was something else, right in the middle of a presidential campaign. It was some sort of high drama, was it not?
What a catastrophe, what a horror that was. I mean, we had it started to build up, and you had the people who were saying, "Oh, we didn't know about it. That was like we got hit by it. It was like an economic tsunami." That's nonsense. Some of the great, I mean, you had Rogoff. This time is different. He does 800 years of financial crisis, and he proves that it is foreseeable. You have had Stiglitz. You have had Schiller, who works in real estate. He does it, has his real estate index. You have a Krugman who's done work in housing and real estate. These people all foresaw it. We had Fred Falvery, a Georgist on the West Coast, and Fred Harrison, a Georgist in England, in London. They predicted in the 90s that this calamity would happen. And Falvery, I believe, predicted it to the month in the 90s.
To the month?
Yes. That's just amazing. Now, we have a clip here from a conference that I attended in 2005. Steve Zalenga invited me from the American Monetary Institute.
Oh, yes, right, yeah.
You know
Steve.
We
did a program with him.
You did a program with him, exactly.
I forget the name of that big yellow book he's got.
The Lost Signs of Money, I think.
I think so, The Lost Signs of Money,
Awesome piece of work regarding like the financial history. So Steve Zalenga invited me to Chicago in 2005, September 12th, and I mean, we can play.
Yeah,
it,
well, let's set
it.
I think we're going to. It's September 12th of 2005.
Five.
And you are predicting. It's about a 5-minute clip or something?
Yeah, it's a 5-minute
clip. And you're talking to a group in Chicago,
Monetary reformers.
And you're
economists
predicting the collapse or the events
that
came to fruition in 2008.
Almost to the month, in September 15th was the big collapse. Lehman Brothers collapsed in September 15th, 2008.
What a dramatic thing. Okay, I guess maybe we can set that up. It's on a DVD, and they can run that tape now.
Now, the man who Adam Smith most credits for having been his mentor, and he was never shy in giving that credit, the man he most credits for being his mentor was David Hume, the Enlightenment philosopher. He's not known as an economist. He is written a slim volume of economic essays, and I recommend them to your reading. They're still readable. Unlike Smith and Marx, and like George, David Hume could write, and he could make himself clear. And all the things that Smith got wrong, David Hume got right. One of the things that Hume saw early on, before even the signs of economics had not been created, one of the things that Hume saw very clearly is, watch the flow of goods. Watch the production of goods. Don't watch the flow of money. That's a shadow. The flow of money, quantity theory of money, that goes back to Hume. Money has to reflect the flow of goods. If there's a gross disproportion, we're going to be in trouble. But it's goods and production that come first, not money. And I was quite happy when I read up in Stephen Zarlenga's excellent The Lost Signs of Money on Karl Marx and Adam Smith. I'm not a monetarist, I'm not a monetary historian, I'm an economist. So I read up on Smith and Marx. Not only did they sleep through their economics lessons, they also slept through their monetary lessons. They made the same mistakes there. So Smith does not have an excuse. It's not like you can say, okay, his mentor got it wrong and he got it right. Smith is not really he's not an economist. He was not a trained economist. You know, he was a moral philosopher, an ethics philosopher. And he's like a communicator, and he says everything and then he says the contrary of it. And he doesn't take the trouble of trying to synthesize it in a logical way. So in The Wealth of Nations, that's why it's always cited, you find everything and its contrary. Now, what did Karl Marx do? I don't want to oversimplify, but just to highlight what the main schools of economic thoughts did, the mercantilists championed the trader, the physiocrats rightly championed the land and the farmer, and Adam Smith championed both of these, and he put the industrialist, the upcoming industrialist, and the entrepreneur above. And then, of course, Karl Marx came and he said, the worker is getting left out. In Hume's time, and in the mercantilist time, in the physiocratic time, the industrial worker didn't exist the way we know him today. So, what's the best of Karl Marx? The best of Karl Marx is that he had a social conscience. And the best of Karl Marx prior to Henry George is that he championed the underdog. He championed the down and out. And his quest for social justice puts him on a moral high ground far above and beyond pretty much everybody else in economic science except George. Everybody else just was worrying about how to make the rich richer. And Karl Marx really introduced the social question, the social conscience, into the equation. And that's his great merit. After having addressed this important issue, of course, he did not give the right answer. And what he did was simply the following. He was not revolutionary enough. He adhered too closely to Adam Smith. He took this whole big mess and jumble of terms where everything is capital and nothing is clearly distinguished. He took that and stood it on its head and said, okay, now we have this mess for the worker. Before, we had this mess for the capitalist. And it didn't really work for the capitalist, as J.W. Smith has pointed out. Nobody really got rich on Smith's Wealth of Nation. It didn't work for the capitalist, this theory, and now it's not working for the worker either. 1989, the Iron Curtain came down with a crash. I was in Berlin at the time. I saw the wall coming down with my two eyes. And people say, oh, the Georgists are old. There are no newcomers in Georgism, and we're going to die out, and then nothing's happening. I don't think so. I think we in our lifetime, I'm 50. I don't think it's going to take 10 years. We're going to see this system we're in come down with a big crash. We've seen New Orleans. We have seen one of the most arrogant presidents in the United States.
Okay, well, you did it. You called it. You said you're going to have that big coming down. And then let's show this again now, right?
Yeah.
Anatomy of Financial Destructiveness, chronology of the global crisis of 2008, which Kai Hainer is the editor, and it's a number of people who are predicting that. That's calling it really, it was averted. The worst of what could have happened, I mean, there could have been a complete implosion of the entire financial system and
yes, so forth.
But that did not occur. But talk to it. Talk to what was going on, and what is the lessons that that George would have brought to what did occur, or what might have been averted, and also what are the implications moving ahead that have George's overtones?
Now, we had a very unique situation in government at the time, and at the Federal Reserve. At the helm of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke had just replaced Alan Greenspan.
Yes,
Alan Greenspan
right.
For 20 years almost.
He was an
Ayn Randist.
Yeah.
He was a complete non-interventionist, like Herbert Hoover at the outset of the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover said, let's not intervene, the Hoovervilles and all this. Mm. If the poor are poor, if one-third of the workforce in the United States is out of work, that's their problem, we're not going to intervene. And that's why he was voted out of office with a landslide. Uh-huh. And FDR was brought in.
Yeah.
Now, so on the one hand, we had Greenspan got replaced by Ben Bernanke, and Greenspan said himself, I was wrong. We should have intervened.
He did?
Yes,
say
he
that.
Did.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
did in the end yeah. say, I was mistaken. I thought I was on the right track. I was mistaken.
He was mistaken about what?
Not intervening, because
non-interventionism
is fine in normalcy. It's
is
fine
that like same as laissez-faire?
That's fine as long as things are working.
Uh-huh.
But if the house is on fire, you have to call the firefighters.
Right, right,
so
right.
Ben Bernanke was an academic,
uh-huh.
If you want, an egghead who had studied the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Backward and forward, inside
right.
out. He
right.
knew, I mean, there's probably nobody on the planet who knows as much about the Great Depression as Ben Bernanke.
Yeah.
So Ben Bernanke was at the levers of power, mm-hmm. and he realized, if we do nothing, like Hoover did nothing,
yeah.
we're going to have a Great Depression times 10.
Yeah,
we're
going to have the times 10, yeah.
We're going to have the worst,
power.
We're going to have to the 10th power. We're going to have the worst financial calamity worldwide, globally. Now it's everything is globally interconnected.
Right, right. We had containerization came along, all that was coming along.
Yes,
and then
yes.
also there had become in during that period or leading up to that period with the AIG or with others, the swaps and derivatives, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, which is a form of insurance or reinsuring backup to the various levels of economic risk mm-hmm. and the economic mm-hmm. order, mm-hmm. and they had been way over subscribed. And what's the relevance of that? I mean, the widespread use of swaps and derivatives that became very almost mystical in terms of the complexity of the formula and everything. But that was another thing that had to be, no way could AIG not be bailed out. But talk to that also as part of the current the situation relevant in 2008.
It was a complete snow job. These so-called financial instruments, they were a complete snow job. The financial crisis started like a contributive cause to the Great Depression in 1929 was...
Margin?
Yes, margin also, but real estate speculation in Florida.
Oh, really? Okay.
Look at the coconuts, the first Marx
yeah,
Brothers.
Marx Brothers,
it
God bless him.
Hilarious. Yeah. He was actually a real estate pitcher. He was pitching real estate in underwater real estate in Florida. He was being a big con man. It's a hilarious story, but it's a document.
Cautionary tale.
It's a cautionary tale because that's one of the reasons that brought the Great Depression to come to pass.
Mm.
And in 2008 or during the decade that led up to it, I mean, complete deregulation is. Freedom is good. Independence is good. Get people as much free enterprise as possible is good. But you need some auxiliary framework. Like, take traffic. People drive on the right in this part of the world and not on the left, and there are traffic lights. And you need a minimum of traffic regulation. Otherwise, you get just major disasters and calamities,
right?
So the same is in economics. What happened in 2008... What led up to the 2008 crisis was the housing bubble and the real estate bubble 2004, 2005, Angelo Mozzillo, Countrywide, AIG. it was a widespread. What you get is, if you, you have to distinguish between resources and raw materials and productive activity, and that's not done. So what happens is, when real estate becomes scarce, it is artificially, the price is artificially driven up. Mm-hmm. Now, if the price is artificially driven up, bankers and people who give credit, credit institutes, like nothing better as collateral but real estate, housing and the land underlying it.
Well, it was, if I may, that the thing that came out after the Second World War, there was a period of growth, and one of the things, more than anything else, it seems to me, if I think about it, not, you know, really well informed and everything, but that gave lower class up in the middle class and even some higher middle class people an ability to build up what would be called net worth. It was the appreciation that grew steady as a rock, mm-hmm. on real estate property, that you'd buy a house for $5,000, it was going to be worth 10 in 5 years, and up and up and up, steady as far as the eye could see. So that was a way in which a great number of people developed some net worth, which, because they had access to a residential property that was appreciating. And that was something that could seem to be, this is going on forever, so you got a lot of subprime loans and other things and introduced with derivatives insurance behind it, so you had a perfect storm building.
That was actually the fallacy, that this would build up indefinitely. It's like if Bernie Madoff comes and sells you.
Well, he's a crook.
Well, but let me just bear me out on the if somebody comes and sells you stock or bonds or whatever and says you get a 10% plus return. There's nothing in the natural world that gives you 10% return. Uh-huh. You automatically know that this is a scam. 4%, 5%, 6% max, that's what's happening in the real world. Uh-huh. Now, you get an appreciation that goes beyond 5, 6%.
Well, it was going on with
which was going on with the housing bubble.
Yeah. And getting net worth into the hands
Bush
of
having,
people. Yeah.
Bush having everybody let all Americans have a home, that's a noble.
It is a good thing.
That's a noble goal, but you cannot violate natural law, you cannot violate economics law, you cannot give a guy who makes $23,000 in annual income $1 million credit, and he's not going to ever pay it back. He's never going to pay back the principal. He's not going to be able to pay the interest.
Well,
so that was the subprime.
But wait a minute. If you buy a house in year one and it's worth $5,000, and in year 10 it's worth double, you've built up.
That's true. That's true.
And then they would flip it.
But the point is that the housing bubble, the real estate bubble, these are paper values. These are not real values.
Okay,
that is a value, an artificial paper value that's created through artificial monopolization.
But there was a widespread sense that this could go on forever.
Well, it turned out it didn't.
And this is it also lapsed over into mutual funds and things like that. We had Silverado. We had exactly.
But it's not a coincidence.
Enron.
It's not a coincidence that those economists who closely observe the real estate market and the resources market, that they are the ones who are better able to predict this coming down. Andrew Mazzone, who was on your program, predicted it at the same time as I did, and I always say the difference between a science and a beer hall discussion or a coffee clutch, a casual conversation, the difference between a science and a casual conversation is that you must be able to make predictions. If you understand the laws of your science, then you can anticipate future events. And if you can anticipate future events, you're not a scientist.
Well, all right, that's true enough, but you do have the uncertainty principle,
too. If I take this keychain and I open my hand, everybody knows what happens.
I was just going to try to catch it to disprove the thing
exactly.
That only hit the ground.
Why
I was going to try and catch it, but I wasn't quick enough.
Now, if
that was quick enough, then you could have an intervention that would have proved your natural law wrong.
Well,
uncertainty principle.
Yeah, but what is it? What is it that makes us be able to predict with certainty that the keychain drops?
Well, we can do it within certain universal, certain principles, generalized principles.
It's gravity. It's the law of gravity, right?
That's true.
So if you understand the law of gravity in economics, or the equivalent of the law of gravity in economics, resources, what do we... how do we as a human species survive? To survive, we need sunlight, air, food, shelter, and clothing, right?
To survive.
Exactly. Yeah. So if 7 billion people on the planet want to survive, we need sunlight for 7 billion people, we need air, fresh air for 7 billion people, fresh water for 7 billion people, and we need foodstuff, shelter, and clothing for 7 billion people. That means we have a guaranteed demand, guaranteed collective demand of 7 billion people who need all these resources.
They need them, but they haven't had them through a lot of the period of time. We've been here 200,000 years, and the resources were all there to the cavemen when they came out, but there had to be a liaison between human
ingenuity
to develop them.
Exactly. Yeah. Technology had to come in.
And so that comes into
In the 1870s, the Industrial Revolution, that's also something Andrew Mazzone is very strong on. In the 1750s, 1780s, we get a release of energy. We have coal and fuel energy, and that increases the productivity of an average entrepreneur, an average worker by 40 times.
Oh yeah, right.
So
right,
we
right.
get an exponential growth all of a sudden. Now, how can we get from the situation we have right now, from the monopolization, how can we get into guaranteed collective or guaranteed aggregate demand of 7 billion people for these resources that are life's necessities? How can we give them the purchasing power to actually activate this? I mean, that's your friend Kelso is one who has a lot
Kelso
to say on this.
Well, Kelso is another way of forming capital, a way where the ownership of the capital assets there's a transformation going on that is existentially significant in terms of evolution of the whole planetary process and everything, in my way of thinking. And you have to have an alternative way of distributing buying power
absolutely.
To people
absolutely.
Other than through their wages earned by their labor contribution to production. You ought to bring them in on the earning capacity of capital instruments or technology.
Good.
Its technology increasingly is responsible for production or the surrogate or the uses of that, and the ownership of those capital assets should be widely distributed.
Absolutely.
That's a way to distribute income other than labor.
Perfect. That's perfect Georgism.
Is that Georgism?
That's perfect Georgism.
It is. Okay.
And we have to break monopoly power, or in Marxist terms, we have to redistribute the surplus. The surplus cannot be in the hands of a chosen few.
Yeah.
It cannot be in the hands of 0.1%.
Right.
It has to be redistributed to the 99%.
Yeah, but the zero
That's what the last zero sum game. That was the last election was about.
Yeah, but also that the idea that the labor theory of value, which informs much of what would be called the socialist left or something,
yes.
Is that all production is the result of labor. They sing the praises of labor, mm-hmm. and that was relevant. I'm from Detroit. They had labor unions developing, and people got off the farm because of the combines could produce. And they displaced labor. It's only about 2% of the mm-hmm. population. It used to be 35% were farmers and so forth. Then they went to the factories. They needed the laborers there. Mm-hmm. But now we're getting to a thing where labor's contribution, particularly in cybernetic situations or highly automated circulation situations, you get an algorithm that can displace 500,000 people who used to do things like that. And there's going to be, in Lord Keynes, in the letter to his grandchildren in 1930, he said in thinking that you're going to be confronted with something in their maturity, which is about now, massive technologically induced unemployment. Mm-hmm. You're not going to need people to do labor tasks that is the main way in which the vast majority of the people of the world get income to buy food for the kiddies.
Yes.
It's by their labor contribution.
Yes. Yes.
And the concentration of the wealth, and the leftists or progressives say, well, any ownership of, let's say, capital assets, it's not only just resources, it's all buildings and infrastructure and everything is all owned by a tiny plutocratic class in every political entity and in the international order. And there's got to be some alternative way, because those capital assets are increasingly responsible for production in ratio with labor. So, and that we may be getting to the point where there's enough for everybody in a way that's unprecedented and so forth. So we need to have an awakening on a large, existentially significant scale in terms of almost evolutionary terms. We may be coming to the end of a long era of scarcity to one where there is enough and in, within an ecological context that is so in, so that it's almost, you have to start thinking, we may be coming to the end of a 200,000-year venture called Homo sapien and coming into a new relationship in the universe beyond zero sum to
absolutely,
where there is sufficiency
absolutely.
For all within an ecological context. So you need a whole new operating manual for spaceship Earth that's not forthcoming from the intellectual community.
Economics of prosperity for all and economics of abundance. Have you followed the films of Michael Moore?
I love Michael Moore. He's
He's from Michigan, absolutely.
Yeah. And there's a new book out. Have you gotten to it
no,
yet?
Not
it's called Abundance. Number one bestseller on the New York Times list.
That's Michael Moore?
No, it's not Michael Moore. It's some guys coming out of the cyber world.
I have to look at it.
Abundance is a book that people ought to be aware of, because the idea, Kai, the idea that there has been, that there is enough.
Yes.
Is very different than an idea where you have scarcity.
Well, that's his whole gig of Henry George. Henry George is against the economy of scarcity. He's for the economy of abundance.
Well, but we haven't had the capability in a ratio with total productive capability, except historically within the last few decades.
I agree.
Since about 1970.
We discussed it at Fuller. I agree with that.
Yeah, Fuller.
We now have the practical capacity to do it. Now, the answer to the economic conundrum and the answer to the, if you want, Kelsonian conundrum is it's not the people who are there to serve the economy. It's the economy that is there to serve the people. Mm-hmm. We can't be slaves of economic situations. It's the economy that is there to serve us. That's the whole. That's the, you have to turn. It's been all upside down. It's been all upside down.
Well, in order to do that, we have to form capital in a way that doesn't concentrate at all in the upper. See, people who have passed, it's all based upon past savings.
Mm-hmm.
Charles de Gaulle warned against that, and so did Harold Moulton, that you can't just depend upon past savings in order to make investment. If you're going to make an investment in a business proposition or something, it's going to pay for itself out of its future earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to tap into where you can be paying for it out of its future earnings. And I don't know, it's 5-7 years that the average payback in terms of an investment made, that's got to be made available to the population writ large, rather than being only past savings, because that's what since Venice or banking, it's the past savings that is used to put up as collateral so you can make an investment. And those investments, many of those investments are dead safe or could be ventured, made dead safe if you have certain things, waterworks and so forth, they're dead certain. And you could have a thing comparable to swaps and derivatives within, that's what Lewis controlled, within the federal system next to the Federal Reserve. An agency called Capital Diffusion Reinsurance Corporation.
Mm-hmm. That's
which
Kelso.
Would be put, that's Kelso.
Yes.
Which would be put for those aspects of the economy that are all but dead certain. There's various levels of risk. And then say, 10%, 15% for risk or for venture.
Okay.
And then there should be different standards for that. But you could have it in casualty insurance, interesting, where the cost of dealing with the risk within the economic order could be safe enough for everybody to distribute stock ownership in those ventures to the mass of the people so they would get income because they're tied into the way that things are actually being produced that is not tied into their labor.
Awesome.
But it's all
awesome.
What they call wage slavery now in terms of we need something really new to deal with an age of abundance. I'm not sure this book, I think that's got something to do with you'll want to look it up.
We should check it out.
It's called Abundance. It's on the name, but that's like a cyber, but that could be an eco-cyber fascism could be coming out of the cyber things like
Kurzweil. We want to avoid slavery of any kind. We want to avoid fascisms of any kind. But that's, we're tapping into another subject we haven't really broached yet, and that's obviously the environmental disasters we've had. In a sense, the Hurricane Sandy has determined the last election.
We had
the formerly Republican mayor of New York, Bloomberg. We've had Chris Christie in New Jersey, who's been eating Democrats for breakfast.
All of
a sudden, they're singing the praises of interventionism and Keynesianism.
It is a disastrous thing.
Totally disastrous. And it needs to be, there needs to be a federal relief and so on. And we've had this, there was this mythological Northwestern Passage, which Henry Hudson, oddly enough, was looking for and he gave his life for. You couldn't find the Northwestern Passage because it was a solid ice cap.
Right.
Now the ice cap is melting.
Young fellow went around in a sloop the other day.
I missed that. Now you have actually shipping is going across the Northern Passage that was not available before. That means we have an environmental change.
Yeah.
We have an ecological change that's been unprecedented in the history of mankind.
Yeah, that's quite correct.
Now Henry George is the only economist of the classical economists who addresses this 100 years before it happened, who says there's no, all other economists say there is a clash between the economy and environmentalism and the ecology. Either we are poor and environmentally happy, or we are rich and we are exploiting the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And George is totally excluding this exploitative relation to nature, and he says we need to get back into an environmental cycle. We need to get back into an ecological cycle, which at the same time is the natural law of economics.
Mm.
And that is the way to full prosperity for everybody.
Uh-huh.
That's Henry George.
Well, that would be interesting. I could bring up in that case Fuller.
He's awesome. I mean, he's very much balanced with nature. I mean, he's a man who was visionary.
Very
before
much,
his time.
Yes, of course. I mean,
you had him interviewed several times.
Well,
right?
I had done an interview with him as a young man when he was way back in 1974. He's a giant, probably the best mind, in my humble opinion, in terms of he's a comprehensivist, and among other things, he talked about anticipatory design science. That is, he would be able to, he was a design scientist, where he could, instead of being concerned with the political context, particularly directly for a good deal of his life, he would be designing artifacts that would be demonstrating effective design.
The geodesic dome
was
fantastic.
It was the most the most efficient way to enclose space,
which is a big concept.
They still got those domes around the world and so forth.
Amazing.
But he also had a concept called ephemeralization.
What's
which
that?
Is
I'm not familiar with
he
that.
He had two terms he popularized.
Yeah.
One was synergy.
Yes.
I tried to catch your keys. Synergy, figures into understanding physics also, is the behavior of systems unpredicted by the sum of the parts of that system maximally engaged.
Yes.
So if you have a resonancy between systems, 100 trillion cells in a human organism, mm-hmm. every cell matters, they're all part of the same system, there's an effect of more than the sum of the parts. And also there's a term ephemeralization, doing more with less through good design.
That's fantastic.
The most fantastic example of that is the microchip itself. Took a room this size of vacuum tubes, the size of this building, to get 2 megabytes of memory with Turing, but now it's going to where it's going to be going through the bloodstream. So you do not have to rape the planet in order to gain effective, particularly information manipulation and so and other things. So through good design and through things unforeseen, there was no way they could have predicted the computer and the things that are developing.
What's the ephemeralization you were talking about?
The what?
The ephemeralization.
No,
the
ephemeralization.
That is doing more
with less.
That's
through
fantastic.
Good design.
Reduce to
good
the max.
Design,
reduce to the
we
max.
Can, we can, we, those are some things that can be characteristic of the overall system. And then by the largest design problem we have, in his way, I would suggest, he passed in 1983, but it would be that to have a design level at the level, at the end of his life, he wrote 2 books, Grunts or Giants and Critical Path, and he took on the political system. He had avoided it as an artist sort of thing like that, but he took it on, and he said that we were making this giant transformation of transcending material scarcity. We had on one vector, the weapons became, and that underlie realpolitik, still operative in geopolitical circles. Whoever's got the gun can conquer and so forth.
Neanderthal behavior, right?
The weapons became species lethal about 1970.
Awesome.
And we were also getting to a point where there were, in terms of the collective population of the world within an ecological context, more haves and have-nots through time. And we crossed the line where we crossed the 50% mark in terms of the research of the Design Science Decade 1965-75, the 50% mark, we were in a sense transcending material scarcity within an ecological context.
We have the capacity to do this, yes, I agree.
That calls for an entirely new operating manual for spaceship Earth within a new context than that which is encapsulating all of human history. So it's a time of qualitative change.
You know who coined that term, spaceship Earth?
I'm not sure with that.
Henry George? It's in the passage.
He did read the passage. Using the term spaceship Earth?
He's using a phrase which evokes the spaceship Earth.
You sure you're not just trying to get everything into the George's school?
No. Read it up.
Okay, good. I've got to reread the book.
No, yeah. George, I think, is in the same league as Buckminster Fuller.
They're
visionaries who foresaw.
And Marx, in the sense they're all interested in social justice and economic justice,
They're people who just anticipate. Centuries, really. They have a vision of centuries of what is to come. Mm-hmm. And that's the predictivity of science. If you're a true scientist, if you truly understand your stuff, you are able to anticipate these problems. Now, this book, Robert Schachenbach Foundation, schachenbach.org, people are interested in how to avoid the next financial crisis that is surely coming, read Anatomy of Financial Destructiveness.
You feel that it is coming. They've had so many things. Seems to me a lot of the people who were bailed out got off scot-free.
As certain as death and taxes, we're going to have a financial crisis if we don't make a structural change.
Oh, a structural change?
No question.
Okay, we only got a couple minutes left. What would be the broad parameters of a structural change that you see for the national and world economy over the next couple of years? We have only a couple of minutes left.
We have to demonopolize, we have to shift taxes, and we have to honor the environment, and we have to work with the environment rather than against the environment.
Okay.
And with Kelso, we have to spread the wealth, and we can't just have 0.01% bleed us white like vampires. We need to make the wealth available for everybody. Here in this country, we have unemployment. Because why? Because everything that we're buying, everything that's being produced for this country comes from outside of the country.
Well, that's from outsourcing and so forth.
Yes, that's a disaster.
They were coming from outside. But Keynes said it's structure. It may be that it's not a matter of policy or outsourcing. It's structurally built in to a situation where the means of production is being turned over to automated systems. That's something we've got to take into account.
But we don't want to.
Doesn't apply to the old nostrums.
Henry George foresaw that we cannot become slaves to the machines. The machines are serving us. The economy is serving us. We are not serving the economy. It's putting the cart before the horse.
Putting the cart before the horse to what?
We are not serving the economy. The economy is serving us. We're not serving the machines. The machines are serving us. It's all upside down.
It is upside down.
Yeah, it's totally upside down. And Kelso, I think, couldn't agree more.
Well, Kelso wanted to see an alternate way to distribute demand other than just your labor relationship.
That's good.
To build capital in a way where the ownership is dispersed as a way to distribute demand. Does that make sense to you?
Wonderful.
Well, would that tie into George?
Completely.
Would that tie into the structure of the universe? Would that tie into the way
It would. That's another one. It's another one of our brotherhood.
I think we need a new operating manual for Spaceship Earth. Thank you very much, Kai.
Thank you so much,
Your
Al.
Pleasure to have His Perceptions. We invite you to tune in. We'll be coming back again tomorrow, trying to ground things in Henry George Jidge, a giant figure who nests with some of the others of the more contemporary. Thanks for viewing. We're coming back again tomorrow. So, Kai.